What I want to talk about today is my 20 years of software development and how security has not happened in all of them. I think that there's a persistent set of problems in the way that software development is funded that prevents all of our great ideas that are generated in places like this and shared and taught from being effective in causing the security that we all envision, or at least eliminating the insecurity that we all loathe. I hope to present a very simple and straightforward attitude adjustment that can make financial officers and operations planners able to cause security to grow up in their firms over time. And if you decide to stay through to the end and not try to beat the 5:20 rush hour, I'll do a one-slide technical presentation on preventing the general starvation attack or denial of service attack. So Yoshi kind of covered a lot of this. My first job was making a melting machine to melt silver down to make a highly resonant magnetic head for Sonicare toothbrushes. After that, I started doing point-of-sale programs for funeral homes and casket manufacturers and logging companies and video rental stores and all sorts of people that no longer really have jobs. I automated paper form filling out and worked on replacements for Microsoft DOS, Microsoft Windows, and the Phoenix and AMI BIOSes. I've run Microsoft Office with no other Microsoft properties beneath it on code that I built. I've been really involved in the hacking community, both in the 80s before I was old enough for the illegality of anything to be relevant, and then after I became an adult, I got back into the community through the sort of full disclosure movement and through not committing crimes, but letting other people know how one might commit a crime. I've spent a lot of time auditing large enterprises. I just finished a very large cloud service hosted about 2 miles from here. I've audited the largest commercial network in the world. I contributed to and architected the very first general purpose fuzzer. And recently I've been building special purpose mobile networks for military, police, and humanitarian assistance disasters. So what I'm trying to say with this is that my history is all kinds of software development and a little tiny smattering of security. And I have a confession to make. I've never worked in a very secure environment. I've been a target of fraud because I'm a jerk and I stand up in front of people. I've been all kinds of reasons that I should be more secure than I am. And I've never achieved even 10% of what I talk about on stage. So the hypocrisy of telling people how to make a little fix or a little improvement or a little tool is that they're not going to do it. And the reason is because something else becomes more important, like investors, delivery dates, timelines, customers, all the things that businesses are actually about. And that's the problem. So NIST says security first. If you go to Burning Man, you know that safety comes third. And so I guess NIST has taken the spot number one. They say that you cannot build security after you plan a product. Simply that NIST has studied everyone who's built software and said, you either have a security program in mind before you start architecting your solution or else you fail. So that's wonderful, but InfoWorld says that you can't really build security from within unless your core focus and your core skill set is security. So unless you're building security tools or working on a security team, if you have a goal like Angry Birds and you're building it, or more importantly like Dropbox, and you're building it and you build security in later, of course you fail. So if security is not a core function of your team and security comes first, then what the hell do you do? And even worse, Earl Biebert from Secure Computing says that you can't hire security. So you must hire security. You can't hire security. The security has to come first, and in reality, security comes last. This is the reality that small teams work in. And this is even small teams inside of Microsoft, inside of Google and Amazon. I don't mean small companies. I mean small groups who have a focused mission. They don't hire extra people. They don't hire human resources to work in a team of four programmers. Hopefully they hired deodorant, and that's about the best you can hope for. Most small teams fail to deliver security, and I would say most in the sense that if anyone here does penetration tests and has ever failed at a penetration test, I'd be shocked. I've never heard of a penetration test failing. And I've certainly never failed to take the crown jewels in any penetration test I've been involved in. Not because I'm good. In fact, I'm not. I'm not remotely as good as the most of the speakers here. So a friend of mine that lives about 10 miles from here and has a business right near his home said, I have a payment system, and I'm going to make restaurants and credit cards work much better, and here's my product. Would you come in and tell me what I've done wrong with the security program? Again, after the product is designed. And for the first time in my life, I realized that I had ethics, and I had to query them about what I should do, because I knew that whatever I told him, whatever my report said, would essentially be written down, put in a folder, and considered at some later date. And whatever features they built in the meantime would cause drift, and the advice that I gave would be irrelevant anyway. So why can't I, who likes to talk and have some decent ideas about security, ethically consider myself a valid advisor when someone comes and says, take my money and tell me what to do? That should be a very easy solution for a security professional. So let's look really carefully at what they have to offer these teams. They don't have time. They may have money, probably not, but they don't have time. So if security is going to happen in those environments, it's going to happen in little tiny bite-sized morsels, maybe so small that you couldn't even hire a security company to bid the tiny job. Implement a password policy. You can't get someone to implement a password policy as a sole job because it's not enough work to be worth doing. You wake up, you say, yeah, 14 characters, at least one exclamation point, fuck it, we're done. So if you have $20,000 and you come to me and say, how is my business going to be made better? Here's my money. What should I give you? What's $20,000 worth? Using the Sigital's building security and maturity model to pick a top 12 items list, like implement password policy and provide awareness training, very sort of first day security tasks, I got quotes between $8,000 and $40,000 to do the same work from all of the illustrious companies that provide security in this region. So some companies are apparently five times better at providing awareness training. And I frankly disbelieve. I don't believe that there can be that difference of skill in telling people, don't write your password down. That sentence doesn't take a lot of expertise to communicate. So we know that time is going to be a problem, and that we can't give big, huge fixes, big audit solutions, big problem packages. We can't change things in big steps because the team has other focuses. They can't stop doing their day jobs just to sit down and then become a security expert for a second and then go back to work, because whatever they do in that security cycle is going to be ineffectively applied. So why do so few startups then have an active security development process if we know that they certainly can't afford in either time or money to buy it from without? And my answer is they can't. They can't afford to think about security because it costs more to tell the boss that we're going to be late with a feature than it costs to get raped at the payment system and tell Visa that they have to give your customers their money back. In small teams, the time is always the constraint, and distraction in particular, the distraction of thinking about something that's not your core mission, is super linear costly. That is, 1 minute of distraction costs 5 minutes of lost productive time as you get back your mindset into doing your day job. 5 minutes of distraction costs 20 minutes, and 2 30-minute distractions in a day essentially ruins a developer's ability to produce that day. I've worked with maybe 500 decent developers, and I've known every time that if there are 2 meetings scheduled in a day and a lunch break, that I've got zero productivity from my team that day. Not every time, but if I expect that as the manager, then that's about what happens. So paying attention is the problem, not paying money. Paying money is always a problem, but we assume that if someone says, here's $20,000, solve my problems for me, that they mean to spend the money. So if we can get them to spend the money differently, if we can do something different, then maybe we can bring the same security that we've been preaching in a way that the flock can follow. Maybe if we translate the Bible out of Latin, the German people will follow. The truth that every analyst knows and rarely will admit, I've never seen admitted on stage by a person saying, what I've done as a professional is essentially to scare the shit out of people for money. I'm a fear monger, I'm an uncertainty monger, and I'm a doubt monger. Fear, uncertainty, and doubt are the products of every good security company. It's just that the good security companies also have actual results. There's work, and then there's remember, if you don't hire me next year, it's gonna suck a lot. So if I hurt you as much as possible, especially in the pride, then I've convinced you that I've provided value by an emotional reaction. So auditing will produce results, but it produces mostly emotion. And what teams do need is a growth process that works, a personal trainer, if you will, somebody that'll be there to be mad at them the next day. What they don't need is a shamanic retreat. They don't need to be told, drink this stuff, we're gonna hallucinate for 3 days, audit for 3 days, and at the end of it, you're gonna become a changed a person. You're gonna have a new outlook on security and life, and I'm gonna provide that for you. So how do you get what you need if there's all these problems in the way? You can't hire it, you can't grow it from within unless you're building a security product. Well, let's get really clear exactly what the goal should be for a small team. The goal should be to grow the security practice slowly and effectively enough that by the time you become a target, you're strong enough to survive. You don't need big security features when you're developing code, but you can't wait to implement them until later. So my plan is very, very simple. Externalize the personality of security. Hire someone like me and have them come in once a quarter and sit down and review the program. Don't audit, don't pay me a lot of money, just sit down, have a conversation, measure against some realistic set of goals, and budget at a fixed rate. And that'll make your finance people and all the people involved with actually getting these services off the ground very happy. They know how to budget per month, per quarter, per week. They get that. So pick a horizon of money and say, we're only gonna spend $5,000 a month. Whether or not that buys us features in the next 9 months, that's irrelevant. We'll just keep cashing it away until we can afford that firewall that's gonna solve all our problems. Treat a security advisor like you would treat an outside counsel. If you build a relationship with someone, then they become the person to blame. You don't have to. You don't have to take the responsibility for knowing what the hell to do next. You have to do it because you can't afford to hire outside resources to build these things for you, but at least you try and you try and you fail, and then you realize what training your people need and you get it, and you build slowly these skills from within. And the difference is entirely the difference between a DUI enforcement attorney who you give lots and lots of money to solve a very small problem, well, fairly big problem. You give these people money, they solve a problem, they go away. And those solutions don't work for us. Those solutions don't work for small companies and small teams. They don't work for budgeters who say, what do you mean you screwed up and now I have to buy more equipment? Instead, changing to a relationship-based model with your security leader gives that person the ability to train slowly in time. So part of the question is, who do you hire? I went through laboriously where I've been and what I've done kind of to set up for this slide. So I'm sorry I spent a little time talking about myself at that beginning. But the reality is, if you're building embedded systems and you have security concerns, I'm a pretty damn sharp guy to ask questions about. I know lots about key destruction and volatility, RAM, error correcting codes in memory. I understand quite a bit about license violations. But if you ask me to tell you how to secure your new cloud database product, I can only kind of pontificate generally. I'm not gonna actually help you. So go find someone that built something at Oracle or built something at Sun or built something for AT&T or who knows what. Go find someone who's used those tools before and who has a security bent, and ask them to come in once a quarter, review your program, and help you identify just a prioritized list of the next couple of things. The job description for this advisor, just so we're exactly clear, I don't want anybody to think differently than exactly what I mean. The advisor's role is to write statements of work so that you can bid them out to your internal resources, bid them out to external resources, compare and make a make or buy decision, and then when the work is done, ask the advisor, is what was done what you meant? Did this work? Are we done? Can we check that off and move on to the next thing? That's all this person should be. This person is someone you talk to and you learn from, not someone who does your work for you. And the second piece of it then is managing cost. How do you get a big fancy advisor? Isn't that money just being wasted that you should have been spending on the magic firewall that'll solve all your problems? Generally, people spend about 30% more on security services than they budget. And the reason for that is always that the extra features that come on the router cost more, but you've already made the commitment to install it. The service contract is an extra 20%. There's always these extra fees that the vendor is trying to plus up. So pick a fixed budget, whatever that is, 0.5% of revenue if you can afford it, is a very solid amount of money to spend on security. Negotiate a fee, say, you know, Riley, you come in here and tell us about embedded systems once a quarter, sit here for 2 days, and we'll give you $100 and our thanks and 5,000 shares. Maybe that's good enough for me. But if that fee is fixed and all of your budgeting is fixed, then your finance guy just delivers a check on time and your program stays healthy and stays vibrant and stays alive. 2 years later, after you've done this process, you'll suddenly realize that you've grown security from within, and maybe you're ready to hire an actual security professional on staff and fire the advisor. Because once you can afford to hire security, of course, you have your own team. So one of the things that matters then is metrics, and security metrics is a total waste of time conversation in all circumstances, except this one, because I'm special. The Building Security and Maturity Model from Cigital is a reasonable way to evaluate how your security program compares to other people's. It's not a prescription, it's not an answer, but it's a decent yardstick. And if you say, can you plot our progress through this process, any reasonable person can do it and provide you with a good view about how your team is growing. So very quickly, the way that the BSIMM works is they divide all security in a software company to four domains: the secure software development lifecycle, governance, intelligence, and deployment. And some three top three activities in SSDL are architectural analysis, code review, and testing. These kinds of activities are exactly what your people already know how to do. So it marries up very nicely to have someone ask questions, get simple answers, and communicate back to the executive management how the security program is rolling up and how the SSDL is being deployed. And before level one, most of these processes are write it down and know the answer, don't change anything yet. Level two is where you start having checkpoints and gates and your process gets heavier. That's 2 years down the road for most companies. And so there's no resistance from the development staff to this program because there's no extra work. So to get the ball rolling with an advisor like me, or with you if you're the advisors for your next clients, or if you're buying some other advisor, it starts off just like a pen test, but right when all the technical stuff really kicks off, you stop. You take the network map, the staff inventory and audit and interviews that happened, take the initial threat model that was built, and you put them in a binder, and you say, we've done a great first quarter, I'll see you guys in 3 months. And then after that, you start with a prioritized spending plan, knocking off 1, 2, 3 bullet items out of the 109 activities in the BSIM. And over time, slowly, slowly, very slowly, security starts to boil up in your company. And this last bit here on the slide, I want to really say this hard. Technical assistance, especially deep penetration tests and audits, are almost totally worthless. Rarely does anyone make the change that is needed. I've seen it at Microsoft, I've seen it at some very big companies are able to consume a report and then turn around and implement the suggestions to the degree that when the next audit comes back, the solutions are in place. Xbox is a great example of this. For most small teams, it's just unrealistic. What you would do far better is to say, maybe our IT staff shouldn't be able to read our email. Just basic stuff. The result is kind of, you've heard, I imagine, in the contrary to fast food, there's the slow food movement. I like chili and some other kinds of cooking, and especially in a slow cooker. The idea here is to make a slow cook security program, not to turn up the heat and try to flash fry everything, not to make a wok out of it and burn the hell out of everything in 4 seconds, but to just get the job done at the pace that it's feasible in a timely fashion-ish. My employer, who I won't mention because this is a non-commercial presentation, my employer calls this a virtual information security officer. And as the virtual information security officer for 4 companies in this area, I can tell you that this program is radically different, even though there's functionally no end result difference. Their spending is about the same, but their feelings and their perception of their own security program is radically different. Rather than always feeling beat up by the consultants, they feel like they're growing into the shoes that are set down in front of them. So again, this role is something that you should consider like a legal counsel. And understand, if you're buying these services, think about engaging with your security team this way. Think about asking them, can we just pay you every month rather than paying you for these big, huge services? If you're providing the service, consider going back to your medium-paying customers and asking them, maybe you'd do better if I came in on a clock rather than when you have big, big needs. So the benefits, of course, at the beginning we heard NIST say you have to begin security early. You get NIST mandate compliance. And here's the real kicker, and this is very strongly supported in Forrester's 2011 paper on software development lifecycle. There's a 30x lifetime reduction in bug chasing costs if you build a security program from the beginning of your software development lifecycle. Literally 97% reduction in bug chase time, because so many bugs are just about ambiguous design, and security design helps to eliminate that to a great degree. You grow your own competence in staff, in-house, and you avoid hiring full-time security staff for quite a while. And by the time you're big enough to notice, for anybody in China to pick on you and say, we're coming, we're going to get your data, typically the companies that I've worked for have found themselves just barely not stupid enough to fall down. And that's total victory. Just barely alive is total victory in the security game. So in conclusion, and I know that I've gone short here, it's the end of a Friday, and I can't imagine that you guys really want to be here as long as an hour of me talking about this. So let me say this. Opting out of security development is just totally unacceptable. Opting in is almost impractical. So you really have to find a different kind of a relationship with your security provider if you're going to end up in a successful, secure development lifecycle. Take it slow and develop an advisory relationship that you trust. And if you have been sleeping, here's the entire talk on one slide. Pay me, and I will run you through a program that I pick, and I'll take your money every month, whether or not you need it. And the timelines will not be under your control, because your team may have more important things to do than to satisfy my intuitions or whims. And so security will come when it comes. And sometimes that means it comes later than you hoped. With that in mind, and finishing off my business talk, I've recently discovered that very few software architects know how to defeat denial of service attacks in general. So here is a brief one-page technical talk about stochastic fair blue queuing. If you pick a random number every minute or so, we use this as a mixer function. We need a random number every so often, and you assign every sender to a hash bucket in a hash table, and every one of these hashes is a random early drop queue. Then people who consume more resources will get their traffic dropped, and people who consume fewer will get through. This works for military firing instructions. This works for packet priorities on Comcast. This works for every queuing of messages that is possible. It does not defeat a very large botnet. There are big attacks that this doesn't work at all against, because so many senders will fall into each bucket that eventually they'll starve every queue. But this does work against almost every unintentional, that is just greed-oriented, starvation attack. There is a very simple solution to starvation attacks. It's available on Wikipedia. It's exactly this algorithm. Look for blue queuing or stochastic fair blue queuing. And this will literally eliminate almost all starvation attacks from systems you design. With that, I have nothing else to say until, does anybody have questions at all?
We got a thing, Riley? And I guess, are there any questions?
Well, I guess early access to 520 then. Oh, nope, we've got a question.
Quick questions. Do you see this model working in larger companies where perhaps there's an internal security team within the company that then serves as the consultant?
Yeah, absolutely. This is what I've been kind of trying to press into a specific part of a Microsoft team, mm-hmm. is that they have a center of excellence that serves about 35 other teams. Mm-hmm. And if you actually rotated each of those experts into the appropriate relative teams quarterly, that internal security team could provide a cadre, mm-hmm. of virtual security officers to each of those teams. Mm-hmm. The cost savings projection is somewhere on the order of 40% lifetime security cost. Okay. It's staggering how effective the hunter-gatherer approach of, well, we've got time, why don't we fix this right now? Mm-hmm. Because you're attentive and you know when you're waiting. That preparation to fix problems is greatly efficient.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Paul Miller, Microsoft.
Hi.
One of the things we often talk about when we actually talk about kind of our SDL is the fact that when you get a college hire, they don't even know about basic security things like buffer overflow attacks. Do you see maybe kind of growing security slowly starting in college CS programs? So that's part of that, 2 years until you started to grow the skill can start before you hire people?
Yeah. My feelings on software developers are very, very biased toward hate. I love my software developers because they're the ones I didn't hate and fire. I spent a lot of time evaluating whether I should just do everything myself. And I'm not very good, so that's not a high bar to meet. I think that in the end, places like Drexel, places like the University of Washington, Dartmouth, these places have programs that are really changing the attitudes and behaviors of graduates. I think picking and choosing from the colleges definitely can accelerate that process. But I actually think that if you take something like the Building Security In model, and make it 109 lessons that you're going to teach every new graduate as part of the program. That not awareness training, but competence training is a viable, realistic first 6 month goal for recent graduates. Interns, of course, you got to give sexy work to, but once they come back and they have the Kool-Aid and the tattoo, then I think stick them on a program of really becoming a security advisor by being advised. Not going out and training the trainer and everything else, but at least gain the understanding of what an advisor would have done in that moment. And that's a cost that a lot of security teams, a lot of software development teams haven't been willing to pay as a training cost. So either really cherry pick your students or accept a higher training risk when you take them on.
Thank you.
Great, so I'll take my opportunity as the chair of the session to ask a question. It sounds like a very interesting model. I'm curious how old the model is and how many other organizations besides yours are doing this.
There's co-invention. I'm sure that this thought has been thought of and built 100 times in different formulations over the years. I wrote this plan in September of last year. I sat down and said, what would it take for me to be an advisor, and in fact, what would it take for me to implement that payment system product, security analysis? And so I sat down and I decided that this was the business that I would have to be in if I was going to be ethical and fully smart, to my own definition, however good that is. So I don't know anybody else who is actually offering a retainer-based security service, who's taking money whether or not they're providing services, because the purchasers are so convinced that buying a firewall or a penetration test is the solution to their problems because the checklist says it is. And so it's been a little difficult to communicate the plan to people, but when they finally grok what they're getting and when, they start to be far more interested.
No, it makes a lot of sense. I guess I have one final question, and perhaps you touched on it a little bit, but I'd like to hear more specifically. Do you view this as a completely replacement for the other model where you hire someone for a specific analysis, or do you see both of these going together, and you recommend companies continue to do both, and if so, kind of how you envision that happening?
My plan is to use BSIMM. From Cigital, you know plenty about Cigital. Their plan is to survey the industry and say, what do companies do? And they say, don't take this as a law. This is not a prescription. But God, it's a reasonable set of milestones. So I think that the program that we build, the software development lifecycle we implement, should be paired up next to, or like tomatoes that grow up on a lattice, should be paired up next to a maturity model where you can say, we have really met to our level of interest that goal. We can move on.
Deskin Miller from Microsoft. What would you say to the company that is already in hot water for whatever security issues are going on? How do they sort of simultaneously perhaps move towards your approach and you know, avoid all hell raining down on them?
Sure. I won't pick on Microsoft anymore or praise Microsoft anymore in this talk. I think I've done both plenty enough. But Blizzard is a local company who has extreme hacker problems. Their internal economy is essentially based on gold rewards per minute played, and fake minutes means fake gold, and that undermines their core economy. When there's an attack there, nothing I'm talking about will help anything. But thankfully, they have $1 billion a month to buy their way out of that problem. I guess you guys do too. About $1 billion a month to buy your way out of problems. I don't know how better than what Microsoft has done over the last 10 years to become the kind of company that is able to respond like that. But what I would say is, even Microsoft's behemoth, the trustworthy computing and all these initiatives that started with Bill Gates back at the beginning of the 21st century, when he said, we're going to make this change, it took all this time for Microsoft to become that. That's the cost of not having done this in the 70s and 80s. That's the cost of not having built this into every single developer program and plan. So I'm sorry I don't have a way to make Microsoft succeed faster or more efficiently, although I come over and provide my comments as often as I'm invited.
Well, I don't want to belabor it, but what if you're not Microsoft? What if you're Zynga or you know, you're making games for the iPhone? I mean, I'm not asking you to solve our problems.
Sure, yeah. You know, the companies that flash big, hopefully they have had this thought before they get that big. That is, you know, a thrust of the talk is get ready before you're famous. Get ready before you're discovered and a target. But for Zynga, I think they need to take a much more aggressive training program and strategy where they may roll whole teams out and put them off of core development and put them onto security feature development first and security feature application. Those are actually covered in the BSIMM. How do you get your developers working with, how do you get your architects working with deployment? How do you get those guys reporting bugs to your QA process? All those pieces are really covered in a good maturity model of any kind. And the goal, I would say, for those people is to essentially spend their way up to level 2 compliance or level 2 measurement. And you know, while the first things are implement secure password policy, the last ones are like audit the encryption library. You know, very, very serious technical things once you have the infrastructure and you're ready for it. Thanks for the question.
Thanks.
Great. Well, there's no further questions. Let's thank Riley again.
Thank you very much.